Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. So let's stop for a second and let's go back about 100 years. 1915 or so, this site, that which was to become Anchorage, was becoming a tent city of about 2,000 people located near Ship Creek. Today, we're going to take the time to discuss the living conditions and health issues of the inhabitants of Anchorage in Alaska with Dr. Steve Haycox. He's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History at UAA, and Dr. Jay Butler. Dr. Butler is currently the Senior Director of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Division of Community Health Services. He's a former Chief Medical Officer for the state and came up here in 1998 as an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control. This is all part of KSKA's Anchorage at 100 years. Over the next year, we're going to be looking at Anchorage in various ways over the last 100 years. And today, we're going to look at some of the health issues related to that. If you've got questions or comments, please don't hesitate to call us. Our local number is 550-550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you need to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Steve, it's just a real pleasure to meet you. I enjoyed talking with you before the program, and thanks for coming.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation.
You bet. Jay, once again, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Steve, lay the groundwork. What do we need to know about this place that was to become Anchorage about 100 years ago?
Well, it may be somewhat different than a lot of people have sort of understood it to be. It wasn't, and I'll use this word, it wasn't quite as frontierish as folks may have thought. What happened was James Wickersham, who was the archetypal politician of the time, persuaded the Congress that Alaska needed a railroad. And the federal government was persuaded to build that railroad, which was in itself pretty unique. It's the only example we have of the federal government providing a railroad to develop the West. And they picked this site because it was sort of central to where the road was going to go from Seward to Fairbanks. And there was another little bit of a side issue, which was that the folks that owned the land down in Seward were a little bit more greedy than the federal government was willing to go along with. So that's how Anchorage got chosen as the site. You could get materials in here by water, and it was kind of central on the line. And that information got out to the general public during the winter of 1914-1915, and that's how we come to have 2,000 people up here in the early spring of 1915 putting up a tent city because they wanted to cash in on this latest boom opportunity in the expansion of the American West is, I think, a good way to look at it. And so they set up camp at the mouth of Ship Creek. It would be on the north side of Ship Creek, underneath the bluff of Government Hill is where that tent city was. But the tent city did not last very long. It was essentially gone as the principal residence by September or October of 1915. And the reason for that was two. First of all, this was a government operation. And the government of the time felt a strong responsibility to not let 2,000 people wander around in the wilderness and let whatever might happen to them happen. And it was a federal project from the very beginning. The Alaska Engineering Commission was the agency set up by the Congress to run this whole thing. And they ran what was essentially Anchorage for 5 years until 1920 when the populace here was sort of persuaded, grudgingly, I think, on their part, to incorporate. But let me read just one little piece. I want to thank Charles Wolfworth for this. That's a name that your listeners will recognize.
Sure. Yeah.
Charles is a marvelous writer, and he is writing the Centennial History of Anchorage for the centennial year. He's working down at the National Archives here in town, and he's been good enough to share with me some documents. I actually read this stuff, 30 years ago, but as I told Charles, my notes on it are in deep storage somewhere, and he was kind enough to share some documents. This is a quote from a government inspector who came up in 1917 to see how things were going. Here's what he wrote. He said, "There have been practically no cases of poverty, and nearly everyone who has come to the town has made money. During 1915, the first year of construction, many people came to Anchorage with little or no means, most of them making enough money in the first year to purchase lots, erect business houses and residences, and have at the same time laid away money." At the same time, the Alaska Engineering Commission laid out the town. That's why the names of the streets, by the way, are letters, because these were engineers, and that's why they laid it out in a grid, and they assigned the letters because they expected the populace later on to choose their own names, and they didn't want to foreclose that opportunity, and we haven't quite got around to
doing that.
but they ran a tight ship. They ran a tight town, and they supplied telephone, they supplied electricity, they supplied water, they supplied sewage, they supplied electricity, and they supplied the hospital. The first hospital was a log structure underneath that Government Hill bluff. Very soon afterward, they put up two log structures side by side up on 3rd Avenue, not down where the Alaska Native Services Hospital used to be, not quite that far down, but still on the north side of 3rd Avenue. And they had physicians there, and the government early decided that they would provide medical services to the whole community, not to just direct employees of the railroad. At the same time, in 1913, the new territorial legislature had passed a law, and I'll just read this very, very quickly. In 1913, the Alaska legislature passed an act governing the registration and restriction of communicable diseases, Section 5 of which provides that every school district outside the incorporated towns will be a health district and shall have a board of health comprised of some citizens and so forth. So the health board had its own physician who was responsible for sanitation in this town site, which grew up very quickly on the south bluff of Chip Creek. And I looked up the statistics, actually, by 1917, not only did you have the physicians in the railroad hospital, but you also had the physician who was part of the health district and was responsible for sanitation, and there was a great anxiety about epidemic, and that was where that all came from. But I also looked up, by 1917, there were also 6 dentists in the community.
Hmm. More dentists than there were physicians.
Just about.
Is that because they were doing more surgery?
I think it's because they were private and they saw an opportunity here, the same as the lawyers and the shopkeepers.
So can you, in your mind's eye, being a historian, what were the living, just back to the tent stuff, this is can be a damp place in August. So I'm thinking, where was the water coming from that they were implored to get, and what was the streets like, and where was the fuel coming from, and where was the light, and paint it? Can you try to help us understand what it really felt like?
Yeah, well, for the first months, it would have been a little bit hairy. I think in May, in June and July of 1915, it would have been a really interesting place to be. There were a lot of businesses. I've looked at photographs, and you couldn't go 50 feet without seeing somebody who was selling their tent as a hotel, or somebody who was running a pie shop, or even a newspaper. Mm-hmm. But the first auction for land lots was in June of 1915, and already by July they were experiencing a lumber shortage up there on the South Bluff, and they were laying out the streets. The streets were gravel, but the water came initially from Ship Creek. They were taking water directly out of the creek and purifying it. Then they sunk a few wells and then a few more, and that's where the water supply came from. They brought in fuel oil generators, and they were using generators to generate electricity. This chap in 1917 reported how quickly they had been able to lay out the water lines and the sewer lines and how many feet they got each week, and they were quite proud of the fact that they were providing.
Putting those in.
They were putting those in already in 1915.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. And I think that's the correction that we all might want to think about a little bit, is that it really wasn't too much of a primitive place. Because it was a government-run operation, and you had a symbiosis there, the government feeling a powerful responsibility to not leave these people stranded. And in that time, the progressive era of American history, people had a lot more confidence in government than perhaps they do now. And so they looked to the government to provide these things, and it didn't feel necessarily that their freedoms were being trod upon because the government was coming in and providing them with all these services for free that they didn't have to cough up tax money to pay for. So the town took shape really quite rapidly. If you came up here in the middle of the winter in 1915, 1916, you would have seen something that looked like a small town in the American West. Let's say Helena, Montana in 1915. Mm-hmm. It came together that quickly, I think.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding, and again, this could be wrong, I just read about this briefly, that Girdwood existed, Hope existed, Sunshine. So there were communities here developed not quite to the same degree because of the railroad?
Or? That's right. What pulled the population in here was the construction effort. And the construction effort was very intense during the summers of 1915, 16, and 17. The United States went to war in April of 1917, and that pulled a lot of the labor force out of here because a lot of people had made their money, and the construction running north and south of here was pretty much complete by then, not all the way to Fairbanks, but certainly a long way up the line. And of course, Uncle Sam wanted all these people. You've all seen the poster, Uncle Sam Wants You. And so they responded to that. So there was a dip. And in fact, for the 1918 construction season, they were kind of scraping the dregs on the docks down in Seattle to get a labor force up here to finish what needed to be done.
Two more questions come to my mind just to kind of flesh this out for me anyway. What about sewage? What about refuge? How'd they take care of that from the beginning, if you know?
Yeah, well, there was a homestead about 6 miles up Ship Creek, the Whitney Homestead, and they put in what we would today call a landfill up there, and they carried the garbage up there by wagon, and the sewage, they just ran right out into Cook Inlet. You uh-huh. see that the uh-huh. town site was up uh-huh. on that bluff
yep.
where it
gotcha.
Is now.
Gotcha.
So it was pretty easy to run the sewage right down into Cook Inlet, which is what they did.
Which was fortunate, it was downstream, but then they had this refuge upstream.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to ask Jay about this planning. I wanted to get a better feeling of it. And the one last question that comes to my mind is, so the economy, it sounded like it went very well, very quickly, very nice, and it was all the railroad.
All the railroad.
And the government building the railroad that drove this.
Yeah. I suppose that one thing that we're not used to hearing is that it was a government town from the beginning, and until World War II, the payroll that kept the commercial part of the town going came every other Friday out of the Alaska Railroad.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Steve Haycox, the Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History at UAA, and Dr. Jay Butler, who is the Senior Director of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Division of Community Health Services and former Chief Medical Officer and Epidemiologist here in the state. If you've got questions or comments, a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Anchorage, you just call directly, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Nicole, I know you're hanging on. You have a question. I want you to keep doing that. I'm going to ask Jay to give us a little bit of some ideas about the health worries at that particular time, and then we'll take your question. So, Jay, we got this. I keep thinking about a tent city on some mud, but moving pretty quickly. There was obviously more thought than I would have originally thought about sanitation and health and so forth. What are your thoughts as an epidemiologist, public health guy, about how things were going and what were would have been the concerns that maybe we hadn't even talked about yet?
Well, I think that picture you just painted is very accurate for anybody who's ever fished down at Ship Creek when you say it's on mud. When we think about the health status of the population at the time, there's two important factors to consider. First of all, what was the general baseline health status of the world in 1915? This was a time when health status was beginning to change fairly rapidly. That was primarily being driven by some of the issues that we've just discussed. The sanitation was understood, sanitation services were more available, and the general conditions of living were much better. At the turn of the century, tuberculosis was the number one cause of death in the country, and that continued throughout that first decade. But by 1915, we see changes beginning to happen. Tuberculosis was now the third leading cause of death. Heart disease had emerged as the leading cause of death, and that's a position it continues to maintain nationally to this day. If we look at the second leading cause of death, huge impact of communicable diseases. Pneumonia and influenza were the second leading causes of death in 1915. Of course, they became far and away the leading causes of death a few years later during the 1918 pandemic. And indeed, that persisted for a number of years after the initial emergence of the 1918 pandemic flu strain. But other leading causes of death included stroke, cancer, accidents. Diarrheal diseases were very common. Things that we don't see as often today were very common then. The infant mortality rate was roughly 10%. The risk of death during childbirth was quite significant. Julian Fellows is very accurate in how he's picked off various characters he's chosen to eliminate from Downton Abbey. Influenza, eclampsia, motor vehicle accidents were very common. The second important consideration is the living and social considerations of being in the tent city. And the fact that it was fairly transient was very positive in terms of it not being the place where people lived for a number of years. A large number of people gathered into a small area with substandard housing is certainly a big risk factor for communicable disease and outbreaks of epidemics. Certainly, it sounds like the territorial legislature was ahead of the game in terms of trying to set up that local administration to be able to handle some of the sanitation issues. In 1915, water fountains had been installed in the U.S. Capitol, but still most public buildings had a faucet with a sometimes washed cup that was available for public drinking. People shared those things. The tides at Cook Inlet were probably an advantage in terms of taking care of human waste, although certainly you want all the waste to be flowing out, not to be flowing in. It was a boom town, so you had a lot of young workers coming in, and the challenges of any boom town, just like the gold rush, the pipeline days, or North Dakota of today, probably there were issues with sexually transmitted diseases, challenges from deaths or injuries from violent crime. It seems that Anchorage was a little cleaner than some of the other boom towns. Certainly don't see anything like the waterfront down in Ketchikan when we look back at historic Anchorage. It wasn't quite a refugee situation. There was a lot more resources available, but the risk was certainly there. And we see that today in any of the humanitarian crises. One that comes to mind is the issues in Syria right now with the refugee camps. A country that hasn't seen polio in over 15 years is now having transmission of polio because of the large displaced population living in temporary housing.
Mm-hmm. If I could just interject quickly. The government people were very aware of these challenges. And the way they set up the sale of the town lots in the town site was that if you used your lot for a brothel, or even if you bought your lot for speculation and didn't live on it, you lost title. And so prostitution was outside the city limits, which ran along what is now 9th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And there were cottages on the other side of 9th Avenue because they could not legally operate inside the city limits. Mm-hmm. So the government was really very cognizant of all of this and tried to deal with it.
Yeah, but what I hear you say is the town quickly moved over.
All right. Well, pass on that one.
Nicole, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Just a question. I fly out to the bush a lot, and I occasionally see an elder or two with bowed legs, which I assume it would have been from rickets, and or any of these other dead diseases or third world diseases or stuff like that. I don't know how you what you call them nowadays, but did we have a lot of that kind of stuff here along the?
Yeah, so you're asking asking about nutritional deficiency kinds of issues. Is that that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, nutritional deficiencies, rickets, and the like.
Okay, good question. We were going to get there, and we will get there. Now, let's address the question of the reason for bowed legs that might be seen in natives first. Is that rickets, or is that something else?
It's possible that it could be rickets. It's possible that it could be a number of other things. When we talk about rickets, it's more of a 20th century disease rather than a historical disease among Alaska Native people. The traditional diet is very rich in vitamin D, even though none of us who live in Alaska have the ultraviolet light exposure that more temperate and tropical areas would have, where we would have natural production of vitamin D. The diet, particularly salmon, was very rich in vitamin D. There were also sources of vitamin D in the interior. If we look back earlier than establishment of Anchorage, we find that the nutritional deficiencies were primarily seen in the European explorers. In addition to rickets, scurvy was certainly very common among the sailors, whereas the plants that were commonly consumed in Alaska, even though we didn't have citrus fruits, were oftentimes rich in ascorbic acid. Sourdough is an example of a native plant that was rich in vitamin C as well as vitamin A. Pellagra was not known to be common here. Niacin was found in fish and in the birds that were consumed, even though that was a fairly common illness in parts of the lower 48 where corn was a major part of the diet. Thiamine deficiency was very common in Asia at the time, but not seen as much in Alaska. Again, because of the important role that fish played in the diet.
Yeah, that the vitamin D question was very interesting to me. Since we put so much emphasis on the importance of vitamin D now, it's certainly a very important product. In fact, it's probably not a vitamin; it's a hormone. Is the way I understand it. It's got receptors. Most vitamins don't have that, and that as we organism moved away from the equator in the north, we had to have some way to make up for the lack of vitamin D, which is produced in our skin primarily is the way we get it from the ultraviolet B radiation. So as you move north, you would think your skin color should be getting lighter, which it did, but now we got a bunch of natives, Inupiats, across the northern part of Canada and Alaska that are dark-complected and yet had no vitamin D deficiency. So I got interested in that, and I saw a study not very long ago where they looked at the diet, and Inupiats in particular, they had no problem because oily fish. And so the lesson is that oily fish is the big source of vitamin D, as I understand it. We put milk in our diet in the early 1900s to prevent rickets, but it was not enough to really sufficiently prevent vitamin D deficiency, is my understanding. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Right. And rickets was observed in the native population in the 20th century and is sometimes still seen today.
Ah, okay.
But much of that is driven by the Western diet and not by the traditional diet.
So when they left the Western diet, that increased their risk for some nutritional deficiencies.
Correct.
This way to really think about that. Nicole, are you still there?
No, I'm still here. And another one, I talked with the elder once from Wales, I believe, and he would tell me that as a kid they would sometimes eat lichen, and I think he said that was they got some vitamin C from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it goes to show that if you evolve and stay healthy in an area, you're doing right. And when we started exploring by ship in particular and moving in places quickly that we haven't been and getting out on water without sources of vitamin C, that's when scurvy became a huge issue, and yet sources were available even in northern parts of Alaska.
So maybe the take home here is anything that your great grandparents wouldn't recognize as food probably is not a great thing to eat.
Exactly.
All right, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
What about this wells? And so I'm thinking epidemiologically, Steve was saying we were getting rid of our sewage right directly into Cook Inlet, which had some high tides, and our tent city and most of the town was above this, to so to speak. So that sounds pretty safe. But he was telling me that we were putting some refuge up above. So how do we get some of these illnesses associated with poor sanitation? Take us back to the how does the cause and effect happen, and even the wells could be at risk at times, is where I'm trying to go with this.
Well, one of the biggest fears in the early 20th century was typhoid fever. It was endemic at that time in much of the lower 48. Tens of thousands of people died of typhoid fever. It's a form of gastroenteritis that's caused by a specific species of Salmonella. It caused an illness that even today is known as enteric fever, characterized oftentimes by diarrhea, abdominal pain, and fever. It had mortality rates of 10 to 30%, higher rates if you were in a situation where there was malnutrition or you were talking about the very young. It was never seen as an epidemic disease in Alaska, fortunately, and maybe that's getting into some of the planning that we've already discussed today. By 1915, it was recognized as an infectious disease. It was recognized that it could be spread through food and water. This was within a decade of Typhoid Mary Malone, the famous cook in New York City who was asymptomatically colonized with Salmonella typhi and infected well over 50 people as she went to various jobs and prepared food and unknowingly was transmitting Salmonella typhi. It was actually a vaccine-preventable disease at the day. It was a whole-cell vaccine, so I can imagine it made your arm very sore. Even the split cell vaccine that I remember getting prior to some travel to Africa in the 80s was one that made you think twice about getting it again because it made your arm sore. Of course, today there's a live oral vaccine that's very, very tolerable. And it continues to be a disease that's very common in parts of Asia, Africa, and South and Central America. Cholera was also greatly to be feared. Global pandemics of cholera had occurred. It's actually where we learned before we knew about infectious microorganisms and before the emergence of the germ theory that patterns of disease could teach us about transmission. We were talking a little earlier about Watney's beer, which is related to the John Snow pub. John Snow was a physician in London in the mid-1850s, and he began plotting the residences occupied by people who had died of cholera and noticed that they clustered around one public pump on what was at that time Broad Street. He also noticed that there were other cases that he pursued and found that the vast majority of those were people who preferred the water from the Broad Street pump. They thought it tasted better. Or they were children who attended school in their area around the Broad Street pump. This pump received water from a part of the Thames that was heavily contaminated by sewage. And although I have to say, as you read about London in the mid-19th century, it's hard to imagine any of the Thames was not heavily contaminated with sewage.
It was a pretty nasty place.
It certainly was. And Snow took his observations to the powers that be, and ultimately, the day after he made that presentation, the authorities removed the pump handle from the pump. And as the legend goes, the epidemic abruptly ended. Actually, right. Snow himself described that it was already beginning to decline, but it's become quite a symbol of how we determine causation and also how we prevent ongoing transmission.
All right. It's amazing to me, but we're halfway through this program, so I've got to take my break here, and then I want to come back and let's talk about the natives and maybe some cross-fertilization of information that enabled us to maybe address some of the medical issues as well here, Steve, in just a second. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll rejoin my guest, UAA Professor of History Steve Haycox, and physician Dr. Jay Butler. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today's program is part of an effort by KSKA and Alaska Public Radio, or alaskapublic.org, to address issues related to Anchorage at 100 years of age. And so what we're doing today is discussing health and living conditions as best we can put it together about 100 years ago here in Anchorage and the surrounding area. My guests are UAA Distinguished Emeritus Professor of History, Dr. Steve Haycox, and Dr. Jay Butler. He is the Senior Director of the ANTHC's Division of Community Health Services, former Chief Medical Officer with the State of Alaska, and an epidemiologist with the CDC. If you've got questions or comments, you only have about 30 minutes with which to get in touch with us. And here is how you can do it. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Also remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m., you're listening to a rebroadcast. We can't take any questions for you, but also remember you can go to alaskapublic.org, look for the Line One link, and you can get to our archives and re-listen to the program or recommend it for someone else who you think might benefit or enjoy listening to us. All right, Steve, so we haven't talked about the native population as we began to, and I mean by we, the U.S. began to develop its railroad potential here in the Anchorage area. What was the situation like What do we know about some cross-fertilization, how these people interact, how the cultures interact with each other?
We have to remember what the time was culturally. Natives were not seen as, I'll use the term that they use, civilized. And so there was a dismissive attitude in part toward natives. Now, native services were provided. The federal government had stepped into Alaska in 1885, and Bureau of Education, for obscure reasons that we don't need to bother with now, provided a pretty broad range of native services, not just education, but also medical service. There was a medical service attached to that agency, and they ran infirmaries in various places. There weren't too many natives on the Anchorage town site. The closest major village would be Iklutna, as it still is today. The Kenaitse people didn't come up this way too often. Natives, of course, were attracted to the town because it had amenities that they were that they knew about and were interested in. There was some labor opportunity for them, but not too much. There wasn't much skilled labor, of course, among the native people. And the government established a school, the Iklutna Indian School, at about the same time as the town site developed. And later on, after 1918, there would be an orphanage function attached to that school. So there probably wasn't a great deal of cross-fertilization. May have been some, but probably not a great deal because of the dismissive, what we would today call a discriminatory or even racist attitude toward the native population that obtained back then. There was kind of a wall of separation that didn't encourage fraternization. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was some. And what the degree of cross-fertilization may have been, I don't know that I can really speak to. One point that I think we do want to make, though, and I think Dr. Butler will make this point as well, the influenza epidemic, the pandemic of 1918, was devastating in Alaska, and it worked a serious hardship on the Iklutna people and on all of the natives of Upper Cook Inlet. Of course, at the very same time, the labor force had contracted here because of World War I and the exit of a lot of people. Still, the non-native population also felt the brunt of that influenza epidemic, and there was a lot of correspondence about people in the railroad hospital and what might be needed here in terms of treating that.
Jay, do you know, or Steve, either one of you, whether there was much, since there was, you know, I guess typically as Caucasians moved in and integrated into areas where Native people lived, there was this traditional looking down on them, so to speak. But they, in retrospect, they had a lot of knowledge. And what I'm trying to get at is there much evidence that there was any useful effort, any effort to try to understand why these Native peoples were so successful, at least from a health standpoint? And here we come in and we have all these problems. And then the subsequent question is, you know, many Native populations, when they become, when they get situated closely with a new race of people, such as the Caucasians, they suffered tremendous health issues as a consequence, often measles and whooping cough and maybe even tuberculosis. I'm not that good at it. So any evidence that some of that stuff was going on in this area about that time?
Well, about that time, the diseases of colonization were certainly epidemic in terms of their impact on the native population. And this was quite a change from some 150 years earlier during some of the initial contact with the Russian explorers when people wrote about how robust the native people were, that they were muscular. The Aleuts were described as being of moderate height, 5 to 5.5 feet, which is the same size European people were at the day. Some of the early church records, again, along the Aleutians, reflected that nearly 20% of the population lived past age 60. So that was significantly longer than what was the expected life expectancy, which was until about 1900, generally less than 50 years of age. As the infectious diseases were introduced into the native population through increasing contact, the impact among Alaska Native people, as it was for all indigenous people in the New World, was profound. These were oftentimes diseases that had existed in particularly the European population, to some extent in the Middle East and Southern Asia for millennia, things like tuberculosis, measles, even influenza, smallpox to some degree. And there had probably been centuries, if not millennia, of coevolution that developed some degree of resistance naturally to those infections in the European population. Spread of the people from outside facilitated the spread. The Great Sickness of 1900 may have been a combined epidemic of influenza and measles. It's actually thought that some of the census takers of 1900 may have helped spread the illness through mm-hmm. some of the mm-hmm. rural areas. We've mentioned the 1918 pandemic, which in some villages had mortality rates of over 50%. Those were not just huge in terms of their impact on all Americans and all people in the world, but had a particular impact in really decimating villages and sometimes removing a whole generation of parents and grandparents. So there was a historical trauma that then emerged as these epidemic orphans were on their own to find their way in the world.
It's almost like AIDS in certain areas of Africa, just wiping out a very important part of the population.
Very, very similar.
Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I actually tuned in a little late, so I don't know if my comment that I'll get to in a second has been touched on, but I can't help but think of Dr. Fortine's book on the history of of Alaskan the population, since mainly the natives, since the early explorers started recording it. Chills and Fever, I think, is the name of it. And reading it makes you wonder how any of us, native or non-native, have ever survived beyond what these people endured. And so I would recommend that for someone who was really interested in the health of Alaskan, early Alaskans. But I don't know if you touched earlier on, you mentioned at the break about living conditions, and I don't know if you touched on the recreational health of Alaskans, but I don't think early on they had a lot of time or opportunity for recreation, but I have to say that half of Anchorage's history, there's been a real significant rise of, you know, the cross-country skiing effort. The Nordic Ski Club has been a huge part of that for 50 years, and our quality of life now, of course, is just immeasurably better with what they have done and what volunteers have done with all of the trail systems that we have here.
All right. Thanks very much for your comments. And I would just add that if people want to get a link to Chills and Fever or to Betsy Towers' book, Anchorage from Its Humble Origin as a Railroad Construction Camp, links to those books are on our website, plus some early photos from Anchorage that I was able to gather, and some links to where you can see some more photos. So thanks very much for your comments, Diane.
Bye.
What about food, Steve? We didn't ask about food.
Well, let me respond first to the recreational health. The government was quite aware of that, and there were ice skating rinks set up early on. Huh. And there are some wonderful photographs of the community using the hill over there where the Native Service Hospital was on 3rd Avenue as a community sledding hill all winter long. And as Diane suggests, early skiing came to Anchorage quite early on. So and they were very anxious to get a swimming pool put into town, and that took a while. But they were very anxious for that, so that kids would have that opportunity.
Wow!
And
who would have thunk it?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a part of are kind of readjusting
our notion of what
this place was like right from the very, very beginning.
Right.
But food came in. I think the diet was probably pretty much the same diet people were eating in Seattle, because that's where all the food came from. And entrepreneurs were very quick on the ground, and it didn't take a whole lot of capital to put together a shipment of canned goods whatever could be preserved, and even some perishables, because it was only a 4 or 5 day boat trip out of Seattle to get up here and lighter the stuff off into the town site. And so probably the food supply was adequate and covered whatever the range people were eating in Seattle in those days here. And if you, as I suggested earlier, if you look around the tent city, you see lots of signs for hardware and for groceries, and of course some of the very first stores that went up in the town site were grocery stores.
When I think about it, I hadn't thought about it before, but when you think about the description of Anchorage early and the medical worries, it's much like a military camp. You got a bunch of people together, some hierarchy, and they were aware already from, I guess maybe that's a large degree where we learned a lot about health and sanitation, was probably from what was going on with the military. I'm not sure that that's true, but it would make sense to me. So it's a reasonable analogy to make, Jay?
I believe it would be. I mean, it was a time, as we were saying earlier, of rapid change, and that was occurring in medicine as well. Paul Ehrlich had discovered the concept of dyes that were preferentially taken up by certain types of cells, which led to him coining the phrase magic bullet, because he was imagining a time when we would use certain chemicals that would go to certain types of cells to treat specific diseases. X-rays had been discovered, both for diagnostic purposes and even some therapeutic use. I think the dangers weren't entirely recognized at the time. These were the days of Madame Curie, who ultimately died of leukemia, probably a good example of the risk from radiation exposure. But there was also a day when it was pretty much wide open. The Flexner Report of 1910 had been issued on medical education, which was beginning to more and more standardize what kind of training a physician had when they hung up their shingle. But there was, again, that was only a few years earlier. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of what we would consider very unorthodox practices at the time. There was basically no regulation of medications. The 1904 Pure Food and Drug Act only outlined 10 what were described as dangerous substances that had to be listed on labels. And interestingly, they included alcohol, morphine, opium, and cannabis. Mm-hmm. Boy, history just keeps repeating itself.
Doesn't it ever?
1914 was the first time that there were actually bans on sales of certain types of narcotics. But patent medicines were out there that made all kinds of wild claims, and it wasn't until some 30 years or 20 years later that the creation of the FDA really began to control what people could claim medications could do and how they were tested prior to use. There was an incident of sulfanilamide elixir made by Massengale and Company that contained glycol, and it killed over 100 people over about a one-month period, and it was not recognized that that was going to be a toxic agent. There was no testing of the drug before it was actually sold to the public.
Steve, it may not be fair to ask you this question, but you seem to know so much about what was going on. What about the surgical stuff? You said we have a hospital here, and we've got people that are beginning just to be kind of prescripted about what they should know, and we've certainly had the Civil War where there was definitely some surgical stuff going on. What was the capabilities? Or remember any insights about what was going on in the hospitals from a surgical standpoint?
Well, I haven't read a great deal on that, but I know that they did have a surgical capability, and that in that two-log structure hospital, they did do surgery. Of course, orthopedic surgery had been around for quite a while, and although it may have been fairly primitive, but I think by 1915 it was certainly maturing, if you will. My suspicion is that if they had time, they would do what we do now in a different sort of context, and that's get people out to Seattle if they could do it. But they did do surgeries here, and of course they built the new framed hospital. That was already up on 3rd Avenue by 1920 when the town incorporated, and that was a bigger operation, and I think that they probably had a surgical theater there. But I haven't read too much about that, so I can't really speak knowledgeably about it.
Let me remind listeners one more time. You had about 10 minutes left in our program. If you've got questions or comments to our guest today, Dr. Steve Haycox or Dr. Jay Butler, about some of the situation, what the life, living styles, and living situation was in Anchorage about 100 years ago, or some of the health issues, here's how you can get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433, and I'll just give you our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and we'll try to take any calls or questions that you might have over the next 10 minutes. Jay, how were infections being treated? You've mentioned tuberculosis. You've mentioned typhoid fever. We certainly were aware of malaria at that time. There were a number of syphilis, as we've talked about, sexually transmitted illness. A lot of these illnesses were pretty well understood and described, but treatment was another issue. Where were we?
Well, oftentimes treatment was surgical, particularly when you're talking about an extremity that became infected. Amputation was still an option that oftentimes was all that was left.
It wasn't save your life, but it wasn't the nicest way to think about it.
No, it wasn't. not perhaps as common as it was during the Civil War, but there were no antimicrobial drugs at the time, so oftentimes that was the only option available. There were some things that were recognized to be helpful. It was not uncommon, for instance, to pack a wound with sugar or other substances that would change the ionic content of the pus, and potentially the term draw out the infection was certainly going back to those days, or using various types of salve that were observed to dry out wounds. Of course, none of these were really studied, and how well they worked is also debatable. And when we look at the causes of death, how often sepsis was a cause of death, likely reflects the fact that infections were commonly fatal. When we talk about surgery, I think it's important to consider also, cancer wasn't uncommon at the day. And that was the days when modern surgical techniques were emerging. Halsted was describing the radical mastectomy at the time. There was a lot of the idea that nothing heals like cold steel, and whether that was a neoplasm or an infectious complication, oftentimes surgery was the route that was pursued.
So infections were a huge issue at this time. Heart disease was becoming an issue, and yet, in my lifetime, as a pediatrician, I came up and started in practice in 80. By the late 80s, infections were no longer the leading cause of problems up until about age 40. And what replaced them was unintentional injuries to a large degree. What happened to the infections?
Probably the single biggest thing was safe and effective immunizations. And when I say immunizations, I'm talking about active immunizations. So it was only a few decades after this that diphtheria and the tetanus toxoid vaccines had emerged. Now, in 1915, horse sera with antitoxin was available. That was pretty hard to get an infusion of horse sera, but it was oftentimes life-saving. And in fact, if you ever have an opportunity to visit some of the historic areas that are associated even with some of the modern pharmaceutical companies, you'll see old stables where the horses were raised and the antisera was harvested. Influenza vaccine became available in the 30s. It was not used very often until much more recently. But the childhood vaccines that really made an impact were beginning in the 60s, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. More recently, the vaccines against invasive bacterial diseases, Haemophilus influenza, Streptococcus pneumoniae. These made a big difference. Now, that really made a difference for infectious disease mortality. Nutrition became better. Perinatal care became better. Altogether, the more general aspect of why has infant mortality and childhood fallen while childhood survival has improved so much relates back to improvements in the living conditions and what's sometimes called the social determinants of health. Steve was describing earlier how in 1917 in Anchorage, poverty was almost unknown, and I'm sure that was a major driver of why the health status of the city was relatively good for the day.
Mm-hmm. Just for perspective, if I might think we're only 10 years in 1915 before the famous Iditarod episode.
Diphtheria antitoxin.
That was a matter of getting good diphtheria point. Antitoxin mm-hmm. from Seattle up to Nome. Through Anchorage, as it happened.
And we hear so much misinformation about immunization and vaccines, I can't help but want to comment that we haven't, and you didn't mention, I don't think, antimicrobials, antibiotics have been so effective, but they are beginning to come back and haunt us, and there appears to be, at least at this point, a limiting benefit there, whereas vaccines still have a huge future and little downside as I think about where we're going to go in controlling some of these infections in the future. We've only got a couple of minutes, but I do have a call here I want to see if we can maybe address real quickly. Reedy, you're on line one, or Warner, is it?
Yes, sir. You mentioned the hospital on 3rd Avenue. that was you were curious about a surgery facility in there. Was that the old railroad hospital you're talking about?
That's right.
Yeah, in 1937, my sister was born there, and about 1938 or so, my stepdad, George Pell, had his gallbladder taken out in that facility, and Dr. Heitmeyer was the physician surgeon.
Wow.
Terrific, yeah.
Wonderful to hear that kind of information.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call.
You betcha. Right. Bye.
We've only got a couple minutes. I got one more call. I don't think I'm going to be able to get to it because, Steve, I really want to ask you is why do we need to understand history? Why do we need to look at history? What can we gather and learn from history that helps us today?
Well, I want to address that, but I'll do it briefly as I can. I think the first thing is we get specific corrections and preventives that we learn from just experience, if you will, and that's historic, and that's practical, and that might be the most utilitarian part of history. But as Robert Fortine wrote in Chills and Fever, it is in the epilogue of that book, he said, we get an improved understanding and an insight into our own heritage and a better notion of where we came from and who we are. And part of that is this corrective of seeing Anchorage as a government town and things pretty organized and pretty orderly right from the beginning. And then in a broader context, I think what history does is because it gives us a broader perspective and a closer notion of what human beings are capable of and maybe what they're not, it really sharpens judgment. And I think all the liberal arts do that. They don't produce the certitude that we would like, that science gives us. But there's something there that we take away that is useful, and as I've said to my classes, that's why the liberal arts are in the curriculum. Even though they don't produce certitude, they give us clues to understanding that we feel are very important.
Yeah, they certainly, if we're open-minded, we can look back and learn from our mistakes where we looked at people as is not to the same degree as education or understanding as that we had, and yet in many ways they were more powerful and better understanding. So our biases and our beliefs can, and with by looking back, can help us understand where we're not as smart as we all think we are.
We'd like to learn from history. We'd like to think we do.
Okay. Jay, we got about 30 seconds. Any comments you want to make here?
Well, our memories are short, and we forget what's gone before. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the cycle again and again, tuberculosis, major killer. It was assumed to be defeated and gone. Those public health programs pretty much withered away in the 80s, and tuberculosis came back in the 1990s because of that. And as you were touching on, Thad, it teaches us humility. I'm a big believer in scientific method and what science teaches us. But we don't always know what we don't know, and sometimes we know things that we later find are not true. So,
thanks very much to both of you. My thanks to today's guests, Steve Haycox and Dr. Jay Butler. Our next program is going to be a discussion with pulmonologist John Clark and Stephen Russ, the director of palliative care at Providence, about talking with patients, especially about end-of-life care. So join us next week. Pat Yak is chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped me today with engineering. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day out there and read a little history.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.